对。
Unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Kathleen.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boss says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice. Beer!
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwave macaroni and cheese dinner and the people who sold it on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Built protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
Views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and calves and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
And good morning, and welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford, 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. I'm your host, Matt, and across from me is Kathleen.
Hey!
Hello. Thank you for joining the new co-host here on An Unbalanced Breakfast, taking over for the departed Catherine, who is off in Philadelphia.
We miss you, Catherine.
We do. But Kathleen is going to be more than capable as her replacement now for this second season, I guess you could call it, of An Unbalanced Breakfast. Over the summer, we'll talk a little bit about the end, about when we'll be regularly and things like that. We may be switching up the schedule already, but just stay tuned for that and bear with us. But here we are this morning on Sunday. Let me turn this down. All right. So, how are you?
I'm good. Yeah, started my internship, so that's off to a start. What are you doing with your summer?
Nothing right now. I have graduated from the Friedman School, but it does not mean I'm employed yet, so still working on that. But yeah, you'll be going to your second year, so.
Yeah,
doing well through the internship experience. All right, so let's get into the first thing we want to talk about today pretty much blends in perfectly with what we're doing here on An Unbalanced Breakfast, and also some previous discussions we've had on the show, including when you were on yourself, and we talked about the piece about millennials, but just this whole concept of food media versus food journalism. Before we get going, let me remind you that we actually have a brand new number here at the studio. If you want to call in, number 781-350-3264. Also still on Twitter at Boxman37, and Kathleen, you're sort of on Twitter, right?
I'm sort of on Twitter. I guess I could log on to Twitter for the purposes of this show. I'm at Kathleen Dale. That's D-A-Y-L-E. That's me.
So there you go. A couple different ways to reach us. We still have our Facebook page up too, Unbalanced Breakfast on Facebook there. So yeah, so this all goes back to this concept of food media and food journalism. And Naomi Starkman, the founder of Civil Eats, her most recent piece gets right to the heart of this matter, basically, and says that basically food is mirroring the trend of journalism in general, particularly print journalism. Everybody knows that is a very struggling medium right now. And you have this whole rise of things between BuzzFeed and clickbait, or as they call it, sharebait now, and also places like Amazon and Facebook getting in this pseudo-publishing act now, and is basically delivering what a lot of people are seeing and what a lot of people are preferring because they don't want to pay for media. And as a result, they're not getting true game-changing journalism anymore. It's a lot of sound bites and videos and things like that, and applies directly to food media and things. There's a statistic here that this was from the Financial Times, that food has become a hot internet property with social media and smartphones fueling viral shares of recipes and cooking videos. Food-related videos were viewed 23 billion times in 2015, a 170% rise from the year before. And then it goes on, this again from the Financial Times, that Naomi quotes, 50% of millennials are looking at food content in their feeds daily. The top reason is they're bored. In that instance, the most successful content is food that entertains. So that may be all well and good for business, but I don't know if it's all well and good for the food system.
So I'm actually curious about that quote because I'm not sure if we're looking at food because we're bored or if we're looking at our social media because we're bored and food just happens to be what gets shared a lot.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Ironically, that Financial Times article is now blocked to me because I've apparently viewed too many articles on Financial Times and now have to pay.
Yeah. Yeah. The bottom of her article also asks for subscriptions to Civil Eats, which I have thought about subscribing to Civil Eats before because I like a lot of their content, but I'm a poor grad student. I don't want to pay for it, which I don't think I'm alone there. Like, people don't want to pay for their media content. I thought something else that was really interesting was the rise of, like, using food to sell, where is it? Like
with the New York Times.
Yeah, and, yeah.
That was like a controversy surrounding Mark Bittman too, right? I forget what the whole story was now, but yeah, they have a New York Times is partnering with a mail delivery startup, and then Time Inc. launched Extra Crispy, a breakfast focused new vertical to develop marketing for advertising partners through native and branded campaigns.
Which is breakfast-focused, but also, like, pretty heavily bacon-focused, it seemed, which doesn't... It just seems like a big advertisement for bacon to me.
Like, but I haven't actually seen it, but, yeah, it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. So a lot of these things are just, like, marketing and ad-based things to attract eyeballs. And, I mean, she mentions clickbait in this article, and that's one of the things I wrote about for The Sprout one time, too, was... one of the articles I focused on specifically was by Tom Philpott over Mother Jones, who is a great food journalist and has done a lot of good work. But then there was a controversial article or controversial headline a couple of years ago about hipsters and drinking their almond milk and things like that. And that was one of the things where, so he wrote this piece on almond milk and the effect on the environment and things like that, and how it's a complete waste to have a glass of almond milk. You should just have a fistful of almonds because you're getting a lot more of the nutrients and everything else. It's literally not watered down. But the headline was written not by him, but by...
his editors.
The editors. So, because they need people to click on the article. And so if it was just, you know, I kind of like... if it was a title like you might see in an academic journal, people aren't going to click on it. But if they see this, everyone got all riled up. But my point there was that, yeah, I got eyeballs, but then people... it put people on the defensive and saying, hey, I like almond milk and I'm not hipster. And that's what the discourse became. And that's what Naomi's kind of saying. She's like, that's good. She says later on that, I'll just read the whole quote. Sharing images of food on Instagram will not save food media. Watching food videos will not save the future of food. In order to really understand food and the way it touches every aspect of our existence, we need real discourse that examines an increasingly complex system, largely controlled by a small number of powerful players. Some of those players would prefer if we all just kept up our insatiable clicking on those scrumptious images rather than understanding what's at stake or asking hard questions, which is what I was saying, because the discourse on that article wasn't about the environmental effects of what we were eating. It was whether or not hipsters like almond milk, or by drinking almond milk, you're a hipster.
Which essentially goes to the same thing that Eve Turow-Paul was writing about when she wrote that article about millennials. And after reading this piece by Naomi Starkman, I'm kind of like, I have a better understanding of what Eve was trying to say. It still bothers me that she targeted millennials, because I don't think this is solely a millennial problem. But
in your opinion, though, like, so I guess the problem here, and I brought this up when we previously, when we had Dr. Katz on the show, David Katz, as well as Mary Nessel, is basically, what do you do then? Because everything feels so short-sighted, as does everything in the world right now. If you go to international things, like from the Brexit to the elections here to all this stuff going on, everybody is so short-sighted, and it's all about the immediate. We need an audience, we need money, we need people to read our stuff. It doesn't matter what we're putting out, as long as we have readers. But your readers aren't reading anything of consequence. And so if you're in this position, especially with the rise of social media and these sound bites, how do you then use that to make meaningful change? I know that Eve is kind of exploring that, but I'm not optimistic.
In your opinion, when did this kind of like quickly digestible food, like pop media, start?
Probably around when Instagram became popular. And I think it was also when you had, and this isn't to accuse a generation or anything, but you had as the generation. So, okay, when I was an undergrad, Facebook was brand new. You had to be an undergrad. You needed a .edu email address to have it. And it was like a very college-centric thing. And then like everything, obviously, you had the problem of people graduating. What do you do? And then, so anyway, obviously it exploded to everybody. And then you had that backlash where, you know, the older people were using it and it became uncool to younger kids. Mm-hmm. And so things like Snapchat and Instagram, and to a lesser extent, Twitter, kind of became popular. And I think that just kind of fed the, even as the right with like the way cable television has gone to, I mean, obviously that's losing popularity, but just like this bombarding, I mean, again, back in my day, you know, you had, even with cable, you had maybe 40 channels, and now you have like 240 channels, and it's just right. Like you can get any, and you have on-demand stuff, so you can get anything you want, and it's just like totally blanking on the term, but just like sensory overload kind of thing. And
do you think those of us who came in like really early on the social media rise use social media differently than like people my brother's age, who's like 5 years younger than me?
Currently, I think it's becoming a lot of the same. Well, it's funny because initially, like when Facebook first started, people would literally post on their wall like, "Oh, I'm at the library," like, you know, to let people know, like, like anybody cared or was whatever.
Right.
But like people took it seriously for about a month, and then it became a bunch of mom jokes that people would post on each other's walls. And then I don't know. Then Facebook itself started changing physically, and now it's just become, I feel like, a series of it's a lot of photos and a lot of like, look
rants.
Where I'm eating. Look, yeah, or political rants. See,
political rants
are photos of like, hey, look at, I mean, I don't want to get too far off course here, but like, look at this cool place I'm at, or look at this cool stuff I'm eating. Everything's great. Like,
yeah.
So I think that a lot of people are basically using it like that. Now.
Like the way I see like food porn is like kind of a status thing. Like, just showing like how well I eat. I think of it in the same way that I think of Whole Foods sometimes. It's very like clean eating itself. It sends a message about your lifestyle more than what you think or believe about your food.
Right. Well, the thing about food porn though, to me, is that it's like, it's not, hey, look at this. It's not this, hey, look at this. Trying to not avoid buzzwords, but like this grass fed, nice wholesome steak I'm eating. It's like fancy stuff. Like you said, it's a status thing, but not a status thing about good food, a status thing about like fancy food. Like,
right.
So, and actually this may touch into a topic we talk about later on with the meat consumption and how the views of that has changed. But it's just like, you know, you see, maybe food porn did kind of start as like, hey, I'm eating like good food, but now it's just become like, oh, I'm at this fancy restaurant and it looks cool, but it's completely unhealthy and it's doing nothing to make anything better.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the unfortunate thing just with the general fall of journalism, and again, how you, and a lot of people, I've had very interesting discussion with people when Gawker was in the news recently. I don't know if you followed that story with Gawker.
I didn't.
And how they have filed for bankruptcy. But basically, so you hear about the whole Hulk Hogan lawsuit.
Mm-hmm.
So that was funded by a Silicon Valley billionaire who has a personal grudge against Gawker because I guess they outed him publicly. I didn't even notice that story when it happened, but for years he's hated them and has a ton of money and wants Gawker gone. So it's like, everybody's like, oh yeah, serves Gawker right. Like, you outed somebody, or you did the Hogan thing, or you did the Condé Nast thing, so you deserve to go. It's like, well, no, they have these controversial things, but look at all the other articles that are coming up and the news that they're breaking, from sports to food to politics. And people like get on this bandwagon, even if you're, you know, even these people who are of Gawker's liberal slant get mad at Gawker because of like some personal thing, and they don't care that it's going away. And it's like, that's free journalism. That's a lot of good journalism.
Right.
And actually, one of their life hacker, I don't know if it's a vertical or a silo or whatever, has actually picked up on some of what the Sprout has published. So, you know, they're spreading even what we're doing or what people are breaking in the world of food. And now they're not going away because people don't understand Chapter 11 bankruptcy. It doesn't mean that Gawker's going away tomorrow. It is still, it's probably going to be sold, but it's still going strong. Just like, yeah, you have people from all, well, even this is like free journalism and people want to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And people don't care. But anyway, going back to food, it's like, do you have any thoughts on how you get engage people more than just a photo of food or a BuzzFeed recipe video?
I don't know, because like, I sometimes feel that this kind of like popular food media is what, it can be like a gateway to draw people in and get them more engaged. But if it stops there, and if it like stops at a status thing, then it is useless. It doesn't go anywhere. Or make any real change or political engagement. I don't know. Like, I'm at a loss too, because sometimes I feel like, where do I fall in the spectrum of food media versus food journalism myself?
Mm-hmm. And there aren't a ton of, because even, so you have Civil Eats, and obviously I'm sure there's plenty of blogs or whatever that I'm unaware of. Even Modern Farmer had to take a break because it seemed like they were going, I mean, they're back now. But yeah, there's very few outlets. And I feel like people kind of in their minds think it could be a gateway, but I feel like it's more of a never ending spiral where you start, it's not engaging people more, it's engaging them less, because they're going to want more and faster things to laugh at. It's not, oh, I'm going to watch a 30-second video, enjoy it, and now read this long form article about workers' rights in Mexico. Or California or wherever. I want to see the next video that I can share.
And what's kind of disturbing is the way that with social media being as dominant as it is, I feel like everybody is kind of a journalist. And not in the sense of like,
well, what
true,
do you consider a journalist,
true journalism, like, but like you have a platform, just the same way that like everybody has a phone on their camera, so everybody's a photographer. Like, not everybody knows how to use an SLR camera or make like good quality pictures, but everybody's a photographer. And I think journalism is kind of the same way. Everybody has a social media platform, therefore everybody is a journalist. And so the lines get blurred about like who is actually an authority on whatever topic is being spoken about. And I think it can be really hard for most people to discern media from journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I also think there's a problem too. Like, again, this is going back to a little bit of the political thing where you tend to, at least maybe I'm sure I'm not speaking for myself, but if you have friends on Facebook who have certain points of view, you may tend to skip over their stuff or block them or whatever. And then you just kind of,
you self-select.
You're curating your own feed to have, you end up, everybody's just preaching to the choir. So it's like, you know, again, this is when we talked about this before, but for Friedman, if you post something in Friedman, you're preaching to the choir, because most people are of the same kind
most
of mindset.
Already know.
And they either know that or they're all and it's like, you know, how do you get, this is what we're talking about, Mary Nestle. It's like, how do you get beyond that?
Right.
And that's a frustrating thing, because right now, I don't think there are great answers. But I do think, so should mention, so that this piece by the name of Starkman is actually first. They're starting this new thing called Digested, and they're replacing their weekly news aggregation kind of piece they've always done with more of an analysis and kind of like a critical view of the food system. So we'll see where that goes. Hopefully that's the start of something good. Any last words on this topic that you wanted to touch on?
I don't know, except that I feel a little bit depressed after this conversation.
That's typically how it goes. All right, so we are going to take our first song break of the morning. Going to play you a new one. I guess Canada Day is coming up. So I'm going to play you a Canadian band. This is the latest from Billy Talent. It's called Afraid of Heights, which is the title track of their upcoming album that drops on the 29th. And you're listening to it on An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Back to An Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO in Medford, 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. That was the latest from Billy Talent, Afraid of Heights, off the title track off their upcoming album. And again, back here with Kathleen, official new co-host of An Unbalanced Breakfast, part of our relaunch this summer. If you want to join the conversation here, the new number for the studio is 781-350-3264. Also on Twitter at Boxman37, and Kathleen is, I can never remember this.
It's at Kathleen Dale.
There you go. So a couple of different ways to reach us. And so why don't you take over and tell us about the bees?
Okay. So this last week was National Pollinator Week. And we're now starting the next week, and it's not National Pollinator Week anymore, but it's still relevant to talk about. So we know that bees have been dying off for a few years now, and nobody really knows exactly why, but one of the possible reasons, or one of the associated reasons, is the use of neonicotinoids. Or neonicotinoids. I don't know exactly how to say it, but
they look like neonics is the short term of it.
Yeah, neonics. it's a class of pesticides that's been linked to bees dying off and possibly colony collapse disorder, which is where bees basically leave a little bit of food. They leave young bees with the queen, and the rest of the colony disappears. So it's a little bit concerning for ecosystems. It's concerning for agriculture, certainly. And last year, President Obama initiated a pollinator research action plan to find out what's going on and what we can do to protect our pollinators. So last month, Connecticut became the first state to restrict the use of neonics, and Maryland also passed a bill that restricts the sale and bans use by consumers. So neonics are a pesticide that can be purchased by anybody, basically. You can use it on your houseplants at home. So this is pretty important. Yeah. So we've also got, there's also some bills pending in Massachusetts and Rhode Island that would also restrict the sale and purchase of neonics. And yeah, we hope that that goes through.
And one thing that I found interesting, so like you said, it's currently a general use pesticide, and they're going to make it restricted. So this is the Connecticut law, would restrict the use of neonics and any other pesticide will kill at least 50% of a bee population when administered at a certain dose. Such restricted pesticides can now only be applied by or under the supervision of a certified pesticide applicator. So hopefully that's enforceable as well, and not just a law. But one thing I thought was interesting, again, it goes back to everything. It's never that simple. In Washington State, there was talk about how they thought they... So Washington State has a noxious weed control board, which handles invasive species. Mm-hmm. So obviously, in theory, that's a great thing to do. Like, they control if there's weeds coming in. Damaging, obviously, they're known for their apples, so like with their apple orchards and things like that, so any invasive species they can take care of and remove. Unfortunately, in terms of weeds, they're very good forage for pollinators, and so by removing the weeds, they are taking away one of the main sources of pollen for honeybees, which again, like you said, the exact cause isn't necessarily known, but could be contributing again to colony collapse.
Right. I think there's probably a lot of factors. One thing that I thought was kind of entertaining, again, I'm going to bring up Civil Eats, but they published an article that asked, do honeybees need their own lobbyists? And I think the point of the article was just to say that, like, you don't really get a say if you're not, like, physically at the table. And lobbyists get kind of a bad rap, because when you think of lobbying, you think of big business, you know, whispering in the ears of your politicians. And certainly that happens, but it's important to note that there are people who lobby for protecting pollinators, for example, also.
Mm-hmm. And the one stat I thought was crazy was that, again, in Washington, there was, this, I believe, it's actually from that Civil Eats article, they interviewed a beekeeper, Tim Hyatt, who estimates he loses 35% of his bees every year, which is about the national average. So that seems like a pretty terrifying statistic.
That's pretty significant. And like, if anybody, if there was a farmer who lost 30% of his crop, like, you can bet there would be people talking about it. People talking mm-hmm. to politicians, people trying to raise as much awareness as possible, especially if they didn't know why. So yeah, this is like really serious especially for beekeepers, but indirectly for all of us who depend on pollinators to get us, like, to have food.
And I think, what was it, Washington, where they showed up at the state house in their beekeeping outfits?
Yes.
So to, like, help, attract, get attention. So, yeah, that's, it's good that this is happening. And again, hopefully we'll help stave off the bees. I remember, it's weird because this has been going on for a while now, because I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, I was walking through Government Center in Boston, and there was some sort of, it wasn't Earthfest, but it was something like that. And so they had a bunch of vendors set up, and there were musicians and bands and things going on one of the stages. And there was a rapper who got up, and he said that he saw, so he was doing a couple songs, and he stopped and said that he saw a report. This was back, must have been summer 2012 maybe, and he said he saw reports about the bees dying off, and he like freestyled a rap about bees and dying off and how people need to protect them and stuff like that. So maybe, again, maybe some hope that it's reaching more of a wider audience.
Yeah.
But
I think in Ontario they're also restricted. So Neonix can
it might not be how you pronounce it. I have no idea.
We'll just go with it. Neonix can be applied in different ways. So for example, you can irrigate with Neonix, but you can also like coat your seeds in Neonix. So that has been a problem in some areas as well. And in Ontario, I believe they are, and I can't remember exactly where I read this, so I hope I don't get this wrong, but in Ontario, they've trying to reduce the sale of Neonix treated seeds. So that they can bring down the use of that pesticide in Ontario as well. So I think it's gaining some ground. Hopefully it continues to gain ground. You can contact your Massachusetts legislators. It's currently pending in the House. If you go to malegislature.gov, you can contact the House Committee on Ways and Means and give them your thoughts on pollinators and how important they are.
Yeah, and I mean, something obviously needs to be done, because I remember I think it was in Pennsylvania, there was a look at sort of recreational beekeepers, and it's kind of exploding in terms of a hobby. And I forget what the statistic was, but there's you know, brand new beekeepers every year that are doing it. But even with all the new beekeepers on the side, it's not making up for the gap in natural bee extinction or colony collapse. So yeah, hopefully they can continue either state-wise or federally establish a law and figure this out without too much controversy. Unlike another topic, if you want to switch gears a little bit to,
yeah, we can switch.
GMO labeling, unless you just want to talk about anything else about the bees?
No, I think we've exhausted it.
So everyone's favorite topic, GMOs, and GMO labeling is back in the news after a couple months ago where the Senate failed to come up with any satisfactory bill that they could get approved. So just to remind, set the backdrop is that Vermont's GMO labeling bill, which will be mandatory labeling, goes into effect in just a few days on July 1st. And Republicans in particular were freaking out and wanted to get a federal bill passed. The House came up with a preemption bill that would prevent states from doing their own thing and make all labeling voluntary. So the Senate has been frantically, led by Pat Roberts, trying to get a bill done before July 1st, before the Vermont law goes into effect. And it's interesting, a lot of, I'm going to forget the specific companies, but a lot of companies are just kind of accepting it, and they're just going to nationally come up with a label, because if there's one state that's requiring it, they might as well just do it everywhere. And they don't seem to be as broken up about it anymore. So Pat Roberts and Debbie Stabenow went away. They came up with this so-called compromise bill that they're now trying to get approved. Ironically, the House, I was trying to figure out their schedule. I don't know. I think they may have been scheduled to be off this week anyway. I'm not sure. But they adjourned earlier than expected, thanks to the Democratic sit-in regarding gun control. So even if the Senate bill gets approved this week, there will be no House in session to vote on it. So basically, Vermont's law is going to happen regardless. Mm-hmm. Of course, they could come up with a bill that would, again, preempt that. So anyway, the so-called compromise that everybody hates would mandate labeling, but it would give you three options. So you could either do a label, just a straight-up label on your packaging. You could put a QR code for people to scan and find out more info. Or you can just put a phone number or like a URL for people to go read, which kind of would, again, defeat the whole purpose of GMO labeling.
Right.
So basically, led by particularly Bernie Sanders, liberals and Democrats think it's terrible. Groups like Just Label It thinks it's dumb. Good old Food Babe has promised that food companies that decide to use QR codes will be targeted by major online campaigns to shame them. Real productive. the Organic Trade Association was pretty neutral on the issue. And then, of course, you had a lot of big food organizations coming out against it, even though, again, more and more food individual companies are pretty much accepting the fact that they may need to go ahead with this.
So I think the criticism with the compromise is that you have the option to not explicitly state on your packaging that it's GMO. Like you
right,
have to go,
the whole point.
You have to go like the extra mile to scan your QR codes in the grocery store or go like look up on your phone the website that's listed. People are not likely to do that. So I think that's why a lot of companies are like, yeah, okay, we can slap mm-hmm. a QR code on there. No problem, because they know that it's not going to make a difference in their sales. Whereas GMO versus like proudly non-GMO is going to stigmatize certain foods.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And again, we try to avoid the scientific argument here. We do acknowledge that there's been no conclusive evidence that GMOs do anything bad to you. There was actually another recent report saying that consumption will have no harm on your body whatsoever. Obviously, environmentally is a different discussion. But yeah, again, it's just like the GMO debate or argument is never going to go away. And it's just hilarious that I just love the timing that they finally scrambled to get this bill together. And even if the Senate approves it, there's no House to do anything with it. So
yeah.
Vermont has won. Basically, officially.
Yeah.
Do you have any opinion on GMO labeling? Do you care?
My opinion on GMO and GMO labeling changes a lot. The more I learn, the more things are less black and white regarding GMOs, and of many things. But I'm starting to see the criticism of GMO, like flat out bad, always bad, never eat GMO, as kind of a privileged position to take, because not everybody in the world has the option to say, like, no, I'm not going to eat that food if it's put before them.
And it may also, because I think it might have the opposite, because obviously people are concerned about the stigmatization of it. But I feel like because so much stuff contains soy or maybe not so much corn, but especially soy, you know, people are going to pick up their granola bars or whatever and it's going to say GMOs. And, you know, maybe there's going to be it's going to be like a dumpster fire for a week and everybody's going to freak out, but then people are just going to stop caring and be like, oh yeah, I've been eating all sorts of GMOs and I'm fine and
yeah.
Whatever, they'll just be blind to it again.
Yeah,
like most things.
Yeah,
but so yeah, stay tuned for that. It should be I find it just comical. I find it entertaining because it's just funny that this whole GMO situation for the past few months and how it's become such a polarizing issue for obvious reasons, but it's just funny that the sort of comedy of errors that the federal legislation's been over this past year. So
right.
We will see what happens. But for now, the Vermont law looks like it is going into effect as of July 1st. Very exciting times. All right, so now we take our second song break. Do you want to introduce what song you've selected going along with our theme?
Yeah, this is Our Lady Peace. They're also a Canadian band, one of my favorites growing up. It's a 90s song. It's called Clumsy, and this pretty much sums up how I feel about the whole Brexit shenanigans right now.
All right. Sounds good. So enjoy. You're listening to An Unbalanced Breakfast, WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
That I'll be waving my hand, watching you drown, watching you scream, quiet or loud. And maybe you should sleep, and Watching you drown, watching you scream, quiet or loud.
So that's crazy. That song's just about 20 years old now, but that was Our Lady Peace with Clumsy off the album from of the same name. And you're hearing, so welcome back to Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO, Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. Sorry, I'm struggling from these, coming back from these breaks, because I currently have two other shows on WMFO, one of which is also, which is brand new, and I keep calling that my other music show, so it's all very confusing. getting reacclimated here to the whole talk thing. All right, so have about a little less than 15 minutes left to go in the show. Again, number here, new studio line here, 781-350-3264. Hit us up on Twitter as well, or Facebook. And we are now going to move into an international story. And you want to start talking about China and meat consumption?
Yeah, so the Chinese government made the radical move recently to... They have a plan to reduce their citizens' meat consumption, which is crazy to me. They want to reduce Chinese citizens' meat consumption by 50% in an effort to kind of curb global warming. Now, it should be noted that China eats a lot, like less than half of what Americans eat of meat per capita. But just because of the sheer size of the country and the population, they have, it's just like an enormous contribution to global warming. Of course, we all know that raising meat contributes to methane emissions and carbon dioxide, and it's pretty damaging for the environment. But I think this is, for me, it just seems like really big news to see a country of that size make such a public declaration that they want to curb meat consumption by that much, by 50%.
So when I first saw this headline, I thought it was interesting. But then when you dig through, I think this is a fascinating story. First of all, well, it's like, again, one of those things where you, obviously China is a rising economic power and all that. But people kind of consider that like, oh, you know, it's communist government, like whatever kind of thing. But they're the ones that have come out, and just straight up and like, we need to eat less meat. Meanwhile, here everybody freaks out about it and nothing can get put into our guidelines that nobody follows. and so they've come out with they have a food pagoda instead of a food pyramid or a my plate. And yeah, and I think it's what's also crazy. So they have their protein level, but then they break it down. They don't just, you know, they don't keep it vague or say a number of servings. They give you the recommended number of grams of different types of protein. So they have like a recommended amount of shellfish and I guess other fish, and then also specifically of pork and beef. So I think that's really interesting, really cool. And then also just shows the cultural differences in terms of the symbology and imagery and how you engage people. So they just the fact that they have their own design of a food graphic. And then, did you see who the two celebrities, or there's three celebrities, one is Chinese, their most famous actress, basically going right now.
But also Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Arnold Schwarzenegger and James Cameron.
Yeah.
So I was watching, dug up some more articles. So James Cameron, I guess, is a vegan and has tried to espouse the positive values in his mind of a vegan diet. But there was a quote from him. I don't have the actual quote right now, but he was saying he realized that he can't just keep telling people to eat vegan, so he needs a different approach. And so they're able to do this right now in China because the government is issuing this, and they've recruited Arnold Schwarzenegger, James Cameron, and Li Bingbing, I believe her name is, who recently played Ada Wong in the Resident Evil series, just FYI. But anyway, it's crazy because Terminator 2 is going to be relaunched, and the Chinese audience is a huge market for them. And so Cameron, who obviously directed that, and Arnold Schwarzenegger, the star, they're 100% on board for this. They're not just, obviously it's a marketing thing, but they're using their influence to promote values that they agree with. Because I guess I couldn't really find out about Schwarzenegger, but I guess he's, according to this video or this quote, he has also cut down his own meat consumption and says he feels great. So I just think this is a pretty crazy story.
It's just amazing because, like you said, we can't even get similar guidelines into our official guidelines for Americans. And where was I going to go with this? but it's interesting because we've tried and failed. Like the last round of discussion on the dietary guidelines for Americans talked a lot about sustainability, and it ultimately was not included in the official guidelines. But here in China, I'm interested to see how well it takes with Chinese people. I think that eating meat is kind of a status symbol, because it shows that you're able to afford meat.
It said that in 1982, the average Chinese person ate just 13 kilograms of meat a year, and beef was nicknamed millionaire's meat due to its scarcity.
Yeah, and
this is gonna be one of these things too. Of course, I feel like that the meat industry is gonna get angry over here too, because you had a lot of, economist, so I'm not totally sure, but you had recently a lot of Chinese companies buying up American meat plants and companies.
Yeah, I think we export a lot of meat.
To be able to, because they have such a huge population, obviously, and their own environment is strained, so they're producing meat here and exporting it to China. So I'm sure some people here too aren't going to be happy about this. I also think it's almost very different cultures, obviously, but it's just crazy that such visible celebrities are taking up a cause like this, and here you have, not to pick on Beyonce, but Beyonce promoting Pepsi.
you know,
and it's how the endorsements over here work.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting. I think it's a pretty fun story. If you look it up, you can see the video that James Cameron and Schwarzenegger are putting together.
I actually didn't watch that video. I didn't come across it.
It's pretty funny. It's just funny, not like a comedy thing, but just like to see them doing this in a different country and promoting this. And again, it goes back to why they're doing it. Partly is to reach, because they're such huge celebrities in the Chinese audience, and that's going to be huge for them.
Yeah.
And movie and entertainment wise coming up as well. So, for today, for this last segment, we're going to kind of touch on a few different headlines. So, continuing along the lines of entertainment and different diets, obviously, the Cleveland Cavaliers are your NBA champions. Led by, you could argue who they were led by, if it was Kyrie Irving or LeBron James, but anyway, LeBron James is the face of the Cavs and arguably the NBA. So he finally won another title after a 2-year drought, and a very interesting article popped up pretty much as soon as he won that attempted to draw a parallel between him winning and being a superior athlete to a temporary ketogenic diet that he went on back in 2014. So basically this article was saying, it attempted to couch itself, but it wasn't really. But it was saying that, you know, it may have something to do with his diet, which he went on for 67 days at one point in 2014. But apparently, according to this is the new thing that all that it actually says that average people maybe shouldn't do this, but athletes, it can work for them. They can slim down and still be great and turn into a championship winning machine, I think it called him. Forgetting the fact that he went on this diet again in 2014, having already won two championships with the Miami Heat, and being to several others. Obviously, immediately after this diet, he lost two championships. He was in the finals, first for the Heat against the Spurs, got lost 4-1. Then he was with the Cavs and lost to the Warriors 4-2. I'm going to say that instead of his diet from 2 years ago, probably the thing that helped him win a championship this year was the fact that Kyrie Irving and Kevin Love, who are very good players, were healthy and not injured as they were last year against the Golden State Warriors. But it just gets infuriating because it's like a real life. It's not even a study, but it's like a sample size of one person who wants to diet a certain way, and people who love this diet are now like, yes, this is the validation we need.
Did we say what kind of diet it was?
Ketogenic diet. Yeah. We didn't describe what it is, but yeah. Do you want to talk about that?
So I'm not Catherine, who can explain the ins and outs of like the finer points of nutrition, but my understanding of a ketogenic diet is basically it's low carb, high fat, and
extremely low carb because you're
right
changing your body to get its energy from fat.
Right. Which my understanding of that is that it's basically like the first stage of starvation. I mean, you're going to lose weight if you adopt a ketogenic diet, just like you're going to lose weight if you starve yourself. That's what's happening.
Well, and that's the problem for the average person. Again, it goes back to what you were saying with GMOs and who can afford this. I will say the articles I'll point out, like there was kind of a rebuttal saying, you know, he did this, like, should you do it? Probably not. And one of the things is you have to maintain the caloric and nutrient density if you go on this diet, which is not easy to do if you're cutting out all carbs. So, again, you have to be able to afford lots of meat or various sources of fat that right. will also give you the same amount of nutrients that you're giving up. By.
And you should really do it under the supervision of a doctor mm-hmm. if you are going to. So, interestingly, I learned from reading about this that the ketogenic diet was kind of developed to treat epilepsy because I'm not going to try to explain the science of what happens in your brain, but basically it can like reduce the number of seizures that epileptics experience. I don't know. It's not something that I would do for myself. Plus, I love carbs.
So yeah, I guess if you want to do this, all the power to you, but don't do it because LeBron did it and then supposedly gave him a championship, because that is such a false parallel. If you want to talk about correlation and causation, yeah, I will say it had very little to do with his diet.
This reminds me a little bit of the whole thing with Tom Brady's diet. He, a few months ago, I was reading that, like, he doesn't eat any nightshade.
Catherine and I discussed his cookbook that is coming, that is sold out, and how ridiculous it is. No tomatoes. No
eggplants.
And even worse. So at least, again, LeBron was doing this temporarily under... He has his team dietitian, a sports dietitian, right. to help him with this. Tom Brady is going by a personal chef and nutritionist, quote-unquote nutritionist, who has previously marketed a type of water that he said could prevent concussions and a type of herbal supplement that could prevent or treat cancer, among other things. So, like a snake oil salesman, basically, is how Tom Brady's getting his information. And now he's going to make more money off of it that he doesn't need off of the lower middle classes who want to be like Tom and not eat tomatoes.
And so I think this is something that you and Catherine talked a lot about in the first season of An Unbalanced Breakfast, but just where are you getting your information about nutrition? Because sports celebrities may not be the best source mm-hmm. of your nutrition education.
Unless it's Arnold Schwarzenegger and James Cameron in China.
Right, except them.
and that was actually another thing. Going back to like LeBron, like, and clinging onto one thing. Like, I remember when Tom Brady was on the radio and said that cereal and soda were terrible for you, or poison, I think he may have called them. So everyone got all excited and be like, yeah, Tom Brady's endorsing. It's like, well, yeah, look at all this other stuff he's endorsing. It's like slow down a little bit. Yeah, you have to just parse it out. And it's, again, things are never that simple.
Right.
All right, a couple minutes left. Do you want to touch on the... organic standards?
Yeah, so with just a couple minutes left to go, there are some new proposed organic animal welfare standards, most of it having to do with poultry. So the rules as they are now for organic poultry and eggs is, like, they have to have access to the outdoors, which leaves a lot of loopholes for like what that really means. If you have like 200,000 birds on your property and just like they're all housed in a barn with just a couple of little doors for them to go out in a yard, you might see maybe 100 or 200 while the other 19,000 or I'm getting my numbers. I'm not a numbers person, but you know, like the majority of the other birds just stay indoors all the time. Or a lot of poultry farmers have like enclosed porches with that are covered and they're like screened in porches, and they call that access to the outdoors. So the new proposed organic animal welfare standards kind of specify what's allowed and what's not a little bit. So that's a little bit of interesting organics news. I thought it was really interesting that some of the people who are criticizing the new standards seem to be doing it from like a health standpoint. They're concerned that giving their birds access to the outdoors will make them susceptible to avian bird flu, which seems totally backwards in my mind, because you're more likely to catch, like for all of your flock of birds to catch flu if they're all housed together in cramped quarters.
Right.
That's not organic.